In the previous lectures, we have been making a beginning with connecting density distributions and potentials. There again, the idea being that we will be working towards building models of n-body systems that are, well, not in equilibrium, we know that that cannot be, but at least that are long-lived to the extent that the system will remain more or less unchanged, and change is only a very small percentage, over many, many of its characteristic timescales. As an example, I had given the so-called Plummer model. Let me remind you. Where the potential is an actual soft potential well, where the total mass is m, and the potential goes as square root r squared plus b squared, where b is some sort of characteristic length scale, and that typically, as you can see from this equation, is the scale at which this potential changes from being parabolical. All right, so this will have a parabolical bottom here, to going like your 1 over r potential at large distances. So near r equals 0, it goes as r squared plus a constant, and at big distances, it goes as 1 over r. Now, we have already seen that this r squared means that the mass here increases with the third power of the radius, and that is clear from equation 244b in the book, where you do the density. If you integrate the mass as a function of radius, to my great surprise, this equation is not in the book. The mass as a function of radius is the total mass, the mass as seen at infinity, times the following expression, r divided by this famous square root, r squared plus b squared to the third power. Or in other words, if you were to make this into a into an actual equation over here where this is dimensionless, you get that this is n times, you can divide all this by b, all right? And then you can get something that looks like this, r over b, all right, square root r squared over b squared plus 1 to the third power. So at very large distances, the mass just converges to m. At very small distances, it goes with the third power of the radius, and that means that this is just simply homogeneous over here. So if you were to try and make a guesstimate of what this would look like in this guy, you would have something that is a homogeneous sphere that peters out at bigger and bigger and bigger distances. This also gives you a reasonable expression of the circular velocity. As you know, of course, V circular is gm over r. And, of course, you can write this as gm over b times b over r, which is this quantity over here. And then you can just simply put that in, where you get this m from this expression over here. And obviously, then, that gives you a velocity that is a solid body rotation here, keels over, and then just simply goes out to larger distances in this way. Whether or not you can get a solid body rotation in the center here is debatable. Later on, when I show you some numerical experiments, we will come back to this. If you plot the velocity versus radius, because of course this cannot be. If you have a ball over here and it rotates like a solid body, then that can't be correct because all those stars are just separate entities. What you would have to do is you stack the orbits over here in such a way that you start with circular orbits and the tangential velocity on each of those circles is given by this, but the orientation of the orbital plane is random. and it must be random because otherwise, of course, you don't, in the mean, get a spherical system. And this is the way in which you can build something like this up in real space and in real velocity. And already, this demonstrates something that I was mentioning earlier during the introductory discussion, and that is that it is already now, in such a simple case, getting to be a little bit on the fringe on what you can perceive, because the velocity structure comes in. I defy you to get a reasonable intuitive feel for what it is to have a superposition of all these randomly oriented orbital planes in here. And then, of course, life gets a little bit more difficult still, because why would all those orbits be perfectly circular, right? Why aren't there any that do this? And there must be, because already here we can see what we must expect. As we had already seen, so the velocity is proportional to gm over r. In the case of the escape speed, so this would be for the circular velocity, where this is inequality, and for the escape speed, it is square root 2 times gm over r, so that's a little bit bigger. Correspondingly, if you were to pick a star anywhere in the spherical distribution and give it a thermal distribution, that is to say, equal energy in all directions, no preferred direction, then, of course, in the tangential direction, you would end up with a larger velocity than in the perpendicular direction here, because it just simply takes more work for the star to go to bigger distances than to just stay nicely on the spherical surface over here. In other words, the velocity distribution around this point would not be spherical, but would be flattened in some way. We call this the velocity ellipsoid. We'll be coming back to this later. Even so, in terms of getting a feel for what stars do under these circumstances, we know from Newton's theorem, Newton's first theorem that we saw the previous time, that is to say that the effective potential is only due to the mass inside a given sphere in a spherical system. We can already guesstimate what a star is going to do. Suppose that I'm going to take a star somewhere on the outside here, and I put it on a random orbit, not a spherical, not a circular orbit in this particular case, but in some random direction. Because this the system in the mean is spherically symmetric, the orbit will be in one plane. I get to be talking about the details of orbits in a moment. Now, suppose that I give this star a velocity in a given direction. Then at first, when it departs from this point, it will feel the mass inside its instantaneous orbital radius. However, as soon as it proceeds a little bit further out, it feels the mass inside a slightly bigger radius. In other words, from the point of view of this star, when it moves out, its pull towards the center gets proportionally larger. Of course, you also get the attenuation because the 1 over r squared effect. All right, so the force goes down with 1 over r squared, but it goes up faster than you might think because of the... It goes down with 1 over r squared, but it goes down less slowly than you might think because this mass is a function of radius, and it increases as you go out and out and out and out. In other words, when this star arrives over here at this particular point, it will have a certain radius of curvature, but then when it goes back in, that radius of curvature becomes bigger. And the reason for this is fairly straightforward. Once this star is over here, it feels less mass than it does when it is out over there, and therefore the radius of curvature of its orbit is less. Consequently, what will happen is that the star will radially oscillate between two turning points, an inner turning point here and an outer turning point there. Where precisely they are depends, of course, on the mass distribution, on the angle of the initial launching of the star, and so on and so forth. But this is basically what happens. So we take these two turning radii over here, and you get an orbit that looks something like this. And this is called the rosette orbit. And already, without doing any numerical computations whatsoever, you can perceive, due to Newton's first theorem, that this is what's going to happen. You will have two effective radii inside which there will be a band inside which that star will typically move. The precise location of those turning radii, I think you can already intuit, will be given by straightforward conservation laws, right? Now, in this particular case, the orbit is a plane because this system is spherically symmetric, right? You might wonder what happens in the case that the stellar distribution is flattened. And again, rather than giving you a detailed derivation, let me show you what you can already more or less perceive by thinking about conservation laws and the basic dynamics. The motion on such a rosette orbit, you can effectively split into a rotating motion that is circularly symmetric around the galaxy, added to which there is a radial oscillation, right? So you have an orbit like this with a characteristic frequency. That characteristic frequency will, of course, be similar to the frequency of a perfect circular orbit, which is given by which we can derive from the circular velocity over here, plus a radial oscillation, right, between these two extremes. Now let us imagine what happens when we take this system, and it is spherically symmetric, of which you see the drawing on the blackboard here, and suppose that we compress it a little bit in a direction perpendicular to the blackboard, and then we tip it 90 degrees, and you look on it from the side, it will look something like this. Now, this planar orbit we were considering is then confined to two turning points over here, all right? And I think you can already perceive what's going to happen next. If I have a stellar orbit that has, over and above this velocity over here, a velocity component perpendicular to the blackboard, that corresponds to a velocity component in this direction. And it's not too hard to think that vertically you have exactly the same situation. You have turning points given by the energy conservation between which the star would be confined. So on the average, then, you would have this rosette motion in this plane, projected onto this plane, plus you would have some other oscillatory motion between these two borders over here. And that is typical. This is called the tube orbit, and already without doing anything in particular, you can see from the basic conservation laws what it is that you would expect. The details, of course, really depend on the details of the potential that we're talking about. So far I've been introducing this only by means of the spherical Plummer potential, but any spherical potential would do as a starting point. And this then is what we can expect. From the point of view of stellar dynamics, the next question you can ask yourself is, are there any orbits that fill this center over here? And that is something that we're going to be talking about later, right? Good. I will pass over in the book the box 2.1. I do recommend it to your attention, however, because that is something which is sometimes very, very unpleasant. What you will want to do is, once you have started on this kind of approach, you will want to populate this potential with stars, and then ultimately you will end up, let me just flatten a little bit, you will end up with a system that you will have to tell your observational colleagues what it should look like, which means that you have to take this entire distribution and project it onto the sky, so that rather than having a mass density as a function of radius, you will need a luminosity density as a function of radius. Now, there already is a translation step, because in there is your stellar population. And that depends on a lot of things. It depends on initial conditions. It depends on the evolution of the stars in this system. And interestingly enough, it also depends on the dynamics. I mean, you might think that this is relatively straightforward because all you need to do is say, well, what is my typical stellar population at a given age? You take your Hertzsprung-Russell diagram or something, you say, well, there are so many stars of this mass and so many stars of that mass, and just plonk them all in, and there we go. We can translate then from the mass distribution, the distribution of masses of the stars, to the distribution of masses of the stars, and then to the distribution of the luminosities, and even the colors of the stars, because those colors, of course, change when the stars evolve. And yet, there is something which goes on here from the side, and that is, again, the dynamics. The reason for this being that the response of a star in a stellar system depends on its mass. As we will see later, massive stars have a tendency of accumulating in the deepest part of the potentials over here. All right. This is for much later. That's approximately here in the course that we're going to be talking about. But due to these effects, some of those are called dynamical friction, the massive stars appear separated from the less massive stars. Now, that means then that when you tell your observational friends what they can expect in the way of a luminosity distribution, and in particular if you're going to be talking about the color distribution, this is by no means straightforward anymore. And it already links with the dynamics in a way that you might not at first have thought of, right? However, once you have determined this J of R, and as I already mentioned, this is by no means trivial, you can get to flatten the whole system into the sky, and that is what box 2.1 in the book is all about. It is a relatively straightforward integration, so I don't want to dwell on it, except by telling you that these ingredients, all right, the mass distribution of the stars goes in here, and of course the stellar population and evolution, that goes in there. So already from a totally simple summary like this, it looks like a messy subject, and indeed it is. In the book, the authors continue with some other potential density combinations which are interesting for various reasons. I will not dwell on those in much detail. There is one which I will just mention in passing, which you will see coming by quite frequently, which is the NFW potential, named after Navarro, Frank, and White. That was a potential that came out of an N-body simulation of a much bigger nature. Effectively, that relates to chapter 1, section 1.3, where the connection with cosmology is indicated. It turned out that from extremely large-scale numerical computations of N-body structure formation in an expanding universe, the shape of the potentials of the density clumps that you form under those circumstances do have a certain interesting scaling property, and that scaling property was called the NFW property. It is on page 70 of the book. You might wonder where that comes from, right? I mean, the interesting thing there is that here, in the case of the Plummer model, the justification for writing it down like this was purely analytical. It has very nice analytical properties that extend even beyond what I've given here. We'll be coming back to that a little bit later when we talk about equilibrium in body systems. And here, in the case of the NFW profile, it came from a completely different direction, just purely numerical computations that showed that this is a plausible profile for the density clumps in an evolving universe. Precisely why that is, we do not yet completely understand. Right? It just simply said that this is the way it goes. In itself, finding scaling properties is not too very surprising. And this comes from something that I had already mentioned much earlier. And that is to say, you can already see that in here, the gravitational potential of a point mass is proportional to 1 over r. And that is scale-free. There is no intrinsic length scales in gravity. All right. That might then lead you to suspect that since there is no scaling, there will be correlations between various evolving properties of an n-body system, just simply because this is a relatively poor thing. It has, there's no structure, right? There's a relatively poor thing, and therefore the systems that you form would have a certain similarity once the evolution proceeds. The remainder of chapter 2 I will basically not dwell upon. So after having done 3 just now, I would say that that is probably sufficient. The next thing we need to do is look in a little bit more detail into what I've already sketched over here, and that is what can we say about the properties of orbits in such systems. Because after all, an in-body system of this type is no more and no less than just a superposition of all those individual orbits, for which you hope that the superposition will be more or less stable as time proceeds. That's what we're going to do next.